The Guardian.
While the Conservatives gloat, the Labour Party reels. I'm Heather Stewart, and this is Politics Weekly. The Prime Minister said yesterday that this new Parliament, with more than 100 new Conservative MPs,
is a vast improvement on its predecessor. And indeed, Mr. Speaker, I would say it is one of the best Parliaments this country has ever produced.
Of course, he would say that, as essentially he now has free rein to follow through on his most coveted promise, passing the withdrawal bill, which he hopes will convince many that he got Brexit done. In order to underline his determination to do that, he announced plans to make it illegal for the government to extend the Brexit transition period beyond December 2020. So what else can we expect from the next 5 years of the Conservatives in power? And as the Conservative Party welcomes its new MPs, the Labour Party is saying goodbye to many of its own, who lost their once comfortable seats. The race for Labour leader is now well and truly on, but as the recriminations from last week's election loss continue, can anyone unite this grieving party? And how can the Labour Party win back some of the votes they so painfully lost last week? What can they do to rebuild the so-called Red Wall? Plus, what is it like to run The Guardian's Politics Live blog in such a tumultuous time in the UK? My colleague Andrew Sparrow tells us later. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, one thing that can sometimes be overlooked in the aftermath of a general election is the sheer scale of job losses in Westminster. Liz McInnes, the former Labour MP for Heywood and Middleton, was unseated last Thursday. McInnes is seen as one of the casualties of the Tories smashing through the so-called Red Wall of seats long held by Labour. She only lost by 663 votes, but given the seat has been represented by a Labour MP since its formation in 1983, the result was a huge shock. My colleague Rajiv Sayal went across to see Liz as she was packing up her things to leave her office by the end of the week. She's disappointed that she didn't get the chance to do more.
You know, I mean, I've been the MP for Heywood and Middleton for 5 years. And in some ways, I still feel that there's a lot I wanted to do. I've been in opposition for 5 years. My political career has been interrupted by more general elections than we should have had. In 5 years, I've been through four elections, including the by-election. So it's been punctuated quite a lot by campaigning. And I would have liked to have spent some time in government.
What's the process been like these last few days coming to Parliament? I saw you yesterday, obviously, and it seems like quite a painful process and a real mix of emotions.
Yeah, it is quite painful. I mean, it gets better with every day. And, you know, I've had some really nice friends who've got in touch and expressed their commiserations. Lots and lots of MPs have been in touch with me.
You mentioned that your colleagues have been very supportive, your former MP friends, but I look around your office, you're surrounded by boxes and bags, and you've got a couple of days to go. How much support and help have you been given by Jeremy Corbyn, his office, John McDonnell and his office, or, say, the Labour Party itself?
I haven't had any contact from the leader's office whatsoever, which is really disappointing. I just feel like we're just collateral damage. I could get help clearing this office if I wanted to, but it's mostly from the staff. You know, the staff in Parliament are fantastic, and obviously they've been through all this before. And I think it's quite painful for them as well. I've seen a lot of the staff this morning who are really upset. And, you know, I've had quite a few sort of tearful farewells this morning with, you know, just brilliant people who work here. Mm.
So what, Liz, are you going to do now? You've obviously, you're lucky in some ways. You're not one of those people that have come into Parliament and you've only ever been a politician. You've tons of qualifications. Biochemist before you came into Parliament. I'm sure if you wanted to, you could go and find out other work out there. But what do you plan to do?
Yeah, I don't intend to return to the NHS. I mean, I've worked for the NHS for over 30 years. I'm 60 now, so my partner's retired. He retired several years ago he was a lecturer in Hotwood Hall College in Rochdale. And we're going to spend some time doing all the things we've not been able to do because he's been retired and I've been working here. So we're going to spend some time travelling, deciding what we're going to do with the next phase of our lives. But I'm in a better position than a lot of MPs. A lot of the MPs who've lost their jobs are just the grieving at the moment. Some of them are in a terrible state and they need some help and support, and I hope they'll get that.
Back in the studio, listening to that with me, is Momentum's National Coordinator Laura Parker, Robert Colville, who's Director of the Centre for Policy Studies, a Conservative think tank, and Matthew Holhouse, Senior Correspondent for MLEX. Laura, listening to that, I can remember us talking earlier in this campaign when you came on. You were quite upbeat. You were talking about making all those arguments. You know, how do you feel listening to that?
Profoundly sad. Deeply, deeply disappointed. Of course, in part for MPs who have lost their jobs, but without wishing to sound in any way dismissive of the genuine pain. I mean, you could hear it in what that former MP was saying. What really makes me sad and worried, in fact, is what the country now faces, because I was upbeat, because I had a hopeful vision for what we could do for the country. I'm deeply disappointed that we didn't win the election, but I'm most sad and really worried for, you know, the 4 million people who are still in poverty, for the people who haven't got their parents into social care, for my friends and colleagues and fellow activists from the BAME community. There are some people not just sad, they're really frightened. So huge sympathies, of course, to good MPs who wanted to do good things, but it's the sorrow for the good things that we now won't be able to do that really hurts the most.
Robert, you were involved in writing the Conservative Manifesto, which, of course, allowed Boris Johnson to appeal to a lot of those voters that Labour maybe thought it could rely on. Brexit was absolutely at the heart of that, wasn't it? But tell us about some of those other issues in the manifesto and the way Johnson can now try and hold on to some of those voters that he's won over.
Sure. So what the manifesto did, and the Tory message did as a whole, was it was precision targeted at the voters the Tories wanted to win. Even the sort of order of priorities, you know, starting with NHS education, GP places, repairing town centres, potholes even. You know, all of these issues were things that, like, genuinely concerned people. The bulk of it was saying, look, we understand, we have heard what, you know, the things which are annoying you in your own lives, and we want to act on those. And I sort of want to pick you up almost on something you said earlier about the Tories gloating. I mean, I think there is obviously an element of schadenfreude, delirious relief, perhaps. But what should really worry Labour is that this isn't Tory exultant Tories. This isn't them saying, brilliant, and the public have completely endorsed every single thing we stand for, now on to the Thatcherite wonderland. It's absolutely not that. Everyone from Boris down has been very, very clear in everything they've said that these are voters who have lent their votes to the Tories because they didn't like Jeremy Corbyn, they wanted to get Brexit done, and crucially, they were prepared, in a way that they weren't in 2017, they were prepared to trust Boris and his agenda, you know, enough to give them their votes. So they are going to be really, really focused on delivering that agenda. And I actually think that, you know, the language some people on the left are using about, you know, I really feel awful for this country, it's just elected a racist. You know, that's not true, and we can have that argument if you want. But also, what does that say to the voters who have just chosen Boris Johnson? I keep getting flashbacks to 1997, when the Tories just couldn't believe that the country had voted for Tony Blair, this wicked socialist who was going to do all the horrible Labour things that they'd been arguing about. And it took them a really long time to sort of come to terms with the fact that, A, you know, he wasn't going to do all these wicked things that they were thinking about, but B, also that, you know, insulting him was to insult the people who'd voted for him. And you needed to actually, you know, accept and understand why people had voted the way they had.
Do you think that's a danger, Laura? Do you want to come back on that?
No, I completely agree with the need to have profound analysis, and there will be some. I mean, lots of people have already had their hot takes. I think I'm going to take my time a little bit more. Our message didn't get through, and there will be podcasts aplenty about all of that. But we have to face the reality of what's just happened to the country. The NHS is on its knees. 4 million people are in poverty. And I'm afraid that Boris Johnson has made overtly racist comments. And we have also just elected him.
And the electorate have chosen, however, to put their trust in that Prime Minister.
Indeed.
They've experienced that 10 years and seen it around them. And they've decided the answer is to put Boris Johnson back in power.
Which is why I began by saying that it's a profoundly sad moment, because I think that this demonstrates just how much needs to be done to reach some people, to have proper conversations with them about how the world could be better, how they could have more aspiration than just getting Brexit done. I also think, you know, people were fed up. Brexit has been exhausting, almost however you voted. People wanted it done, and the complexity, and I think it will be a long, you know, we'll be at it for years and years and years. But Boris Johnson and his team successfully condense the complexity of our rearrangement of our entire relationship with the continent into three easy words, and maybe at the end of three tiresome years, that was clearly just enough for some people. And on the other hand, I think hope dashed repeatedly, questions about how much you could trust politicians of any stripe, meant that much of what Labour was offering, this very positive vision, people couldn't get their arms around it and obviously couldn't believe it enough.
There was an awful lot of it, wasn't there?
There was an awful lot of it. And I will not be the first who's very supportive of our manifesto to say that I think in some ways there wasn't too much because a huge amount needs to be done, but we didn't manage to...
We certainly couldn't condense it into a slogan, really, could you? Or
I felt it was like the brilliant restaurant where you know that 500 dishes are really great, but there are 500 and in the end you pick a margarita pizza because it's all just a bit overwhelming.
Matthew, that slogan, I mean, I was on Boris Johnson's final sort of 48 hours of campaigning and had to stand in a JCB factory while he drove through a wall of polystyrene bricks with gridlock written on them in a bulldozer, which was not a highlight in my last 6 months, I have to say. But that slogan was incredibly telling. But does it really represent what we're going to see in the next 12 months or so?
No, it doesn't. I think the interesting thing about the PM's campaign is, you know, the promise of stability is huge political currency. Sometimes voters demand change. After 3 years of political chaos and hung parliaments, created and contributed by Mr. Boris Johnson to a large extent, Jeremy Corbyn thought he could profit from that very handsomely and took the decisions he did to effectively cook Theresa May's government. Boris Johnson offered stability, and that has proven effective. But this election really was about picking your revolution. One path would be Jeremy Corbyn and his program of nationalisation and redistribution of power, which we know very well. But the truth is that, you know, the UK will, in 12 months, be leaving the single market and the customs union. That might be with some sort of FTA, or it might be without a deal. My personal view is that for many industries, for many people in this country, the difference between an FTA and a no-deal scenario...
Free trade agreement, we should say.
Sorry, a free trade agreement and a no-deal scenario, the difference will be marginal. You know, if you work in chemicals, the difference between a free trade agreement and a no-deal scenario, it doesn't make much difference to you. So, you know, by default, there will be a very rapid adjustment to the UK's economic model. So, the promise of stability will prove to be illusory.
And what about this idea that we hear a lot, that you certainly do around in Westminster, that because Boris Johnson now has a lovely, comfortable majority, he doesn't have to be so beholden to the right wing of his party, to the European research groups, to all those difficult MPs who made it difficult for Theresa May to shape her own deal, for him to get his previous deal through, and that therefore he'll pivot towards some kind of softer Brexit?
Downing Street in the past couple of days, you know, have been at lobby briefings where they've been trying to push back very firmly against this. Having a majority of 80 gives Boris Johnson room to compromise at the edges where he needs to. But fundamentally, you know, he wants to do a deal in a year. He wants to leave the customs union. He wants to leave the single market. He and Dom Cummings believe that the ability to diverge is a sort of cardinal principle of itself.
This is the idea that we would have different... We are able to set our own rules and regulations, have different
things, regardless of the cost-benefit analysis of that, regardless of whether that's actually really what the car-making industry wants, regardless of whether there's any sort of real upside to it. The ability to diverge is a sacred constitutional principle for them. Once you've baked in those red lines, you know, the ability to soften, really, I don't see what's left to soften after that. I mean, and the difference between what they think and what the ERG think actually seems pretty thin to me. And in many ways, actually, you know, Cummings is more radical than many sort of backbench members of the ERG because he's thought a lot more deeply about this. And so he feels, you know, very passionately about GDPR and the ability to do different things in terms of data regulation, where other MPs actually who've been allied to the Brexit cause haven't actually really thought
probably
that deeply a lot of
spent much
this
time
stuff.
Thinking yeah. about that. Robert, talk to us a bit about Dominic Cummings and the extent to which he was the driving force. You mentioned him there as one of the people who was involved in the manifesto, obviously. How important a sort of intellectual driving force is he going to be behind this government, do you think?
One mistake I think people absolutely make and have made throughout is to view Boris Johnson as a sort of pawn of Dominic Cummings. You know, it was Boris Johnson who set this strategy. It was Boris Johnson who, when he became leader, went to Dominic Cummings, you know, like just days before he became Prime Minister, and said, look, I want you to run this because we need to get Brexit done, because we need to do all the following things. It's Boris Johnson who has been standing up there and saying again and again and again, we need to deliver for these Northern voters. So there's no denying that Dom is enormously influential within Downing Street. The commitment within the manifesto, for example, to invest in science and innovation, that's absolutely one of the things he's been, you know, talking about this stuff for decades. But ultimately, this is Boris Johnson's government. You know, he's got some very talented and fierce and clever and disciplined people working for him. But, you know, the Prime Minister is the Prime Minister.
The science stuff is really fascinating. There's big ideas about increasing the science budget, giving scientists more flexibility, leaving aside the incredible headwinds that you will get as you jump out the single market and customs union. The fact remains the Prime Minister does have a huge majority. They have got money to borrow and spend. They do have ambitions to do new things with regulation. There will be interesting things that they can do. You know, the idea
so we
that
are looking at quite a radical reshaping of Britain's economic model here is what you're saying.
There is the capacity to do that. I mean, I would say, you know, Britain's economic model is going to be radically reshaped
by Brexit
at the stroke of midnight. The question is, how well can you adjust to that? What policy responses you can do that? And crucially, whether the deal that they agree in Brussels will allow them to do that, because it is a fact that if they are going to sign up to things such as dynamic alignment on state aid, then the ability both for subsidies, but more importantly, tax policy will be curtailed. And if you are going to go through this change, then it will be quite important for the government to actually have those levers to pull on.
Yeah, and I went to the press conference during the campaign where Boris Johnson boasted about how it would be easier to bail out British companies after Brexit, which felt quite an extraordinary event to go to from a Conservative leader. There's something sort of slightly upside down about it. Well, but how does he manage to deliver on the other promises to those Northern voters? It's not that easy, is it, in a relatively short period of time? 5 years is a relatively short period of time in political terms, for voters to be able to see and feel the nurses, the potholes being filled, the train services getting better, all that stuff.
Sure. And yeah, I mean, so train services in particular, things like that, they take time. I mean, we've seen with, you know, HS2, Crossrail, Heathrow, you know, even big scale, but also small scale infrastructure. You know, if you're pouring the concrete now, you might not get it by the next election. There's a sort of big overarching promise, which is, it's not actually about 50,000 more nurses, you know, 50 million more GP appointments or what have you. It's about making the state work better in a kind of sort of very fundamental way. It's about sort of like trying to make it so that, you know, when taxpayers' money goes in, better things come out. That everyone, you know, that people have a tangibly better experience of their public services, of the streets they live on, of the level of crime around them. And, you know, that they feel that places around them, that their families, that themselves are, you know, are in a better position.
That's incredibly difficult to do. I mean, that's kind of rebuilding the machine of government almost, isn't it? I mean, it's
yeah, and I think that's behind quite a lot of the stories you're seeing about machinery of government changes, which, you know, might sound like, you know, they're not sort of a first order thing. They were, you know, they're not the thing you sell to people, but you need to do them. Certainly, I know, you know, people like Dominic Cummings feel that you need to do these in order to then deliver for people down the line.
Kind of fascinating, isn't it, that the Tories were sort of selling themselves a bit, but they want to get Brexit done, but a bit of sort of stability and continuity. And actually, we're talking about something really quite radical, while at the same time they were able to present Labour as dangerously radical.
I mean, actually, the thing is, in the election, we didn't talk about much of this at all. I'm sitting opposite one of its authors, I now discover, but you had more pictures than words, I think, in the Tory manifesto. And the Prime Minister, I'm not suggesting the words weren't brilliantly written or very concise, but the Prime Minister, I mean, you will agree, very rarely spoke about anything. On all of the TV debates, pretty much whatever the question was, the answer was get Brexit done. And I think probably one of the few honest things he's ever said is that people lent votes to him to get Brexit done. I don't think many people know about this wider agenda. And I believe it when I see it, because this is the government that has just given us 10 years of austerity. And no rising tide lifts all boats. There has to be an absolute push to end inequality. And this, for me, is a massive difference between what the Conservatives are now saying and what Labour has said. However little we may have managed to get it through, that this is also about ending inequality. And that is not going to be turned around in 5 years. And it's certainly not going to be turned around in 5 years if we're also falling off an economic cliff because of Brexit.
I mean, what I come back to is that this is, in some ways, the shame of Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party, that it's led by people who have devoted their entire lives to the working class, or at least to an idealised version of the working class in their own heads. And they have overseen the absolute severance of the Labour Party from that working class. I mean, you know, red car turned into blue car, as Boris himself said. You know, the people in those communities, the skilled working class, voted overwhelmingly for the Conservative Party. Everyone talks about the red wall. What the red wall is, it's not just a band of seats which happen to kind of stretch across the country. James Kanagasorium, who came up with the idea, he points out that what this is seats which demographically should have been Tory, but for reasons of history and culture weren't. You know, but if you'd had those people in any other part of the country, they'd been voting Tory. And what's happened? Well, Brexit has effectively allowed counterbalance that element. So, you know, and why those people, the people who for whom Labour was founded, Labour's central identity is the party of those people, and those people are no longer Labour.
I can only hope, and this is obviously now the task of the Labour Party, that wall has buckled rather than completely crumbled. We need to be very careful about assuming that Labour has lost all the working class, because significant numbers of working class people across the country have voted for Labour, and 50 of the 60 poorest constituencies in the country still have Labour Party MPs. But there are some very interesting characteristics about those seats where we did just lose, and I definitely need a bit more sleep and a Christmas holiday before I think I could do justice to the analysis of exactly what has gone on there.
There's lots more to talk about, but we're going to take a break there. Come back to us after the break, when Andrew Sparrow talks us through a typical day running the Politics Live blog, and the panel and I talk more about Brexit. We'll be right back. Now, given how fast-moving political news is at the moment, my colleague Andrew Sparrow's Politics Live blog is an absolute must. Let's hear from Andrew about a typical day at the helm and how he separates fact from fiction in real time in the world of social media.
I still think of myself as a newspaper journalist. I trained in local papers on the South Wales Echo. I came to Westminster in 94. My first job was working for Thompson Regional Newspapers, and I worked for various other papers. And then I took a couple of years off for family reasons, and I wanted to come back into politics journalism. And this was 2008. The Guardian was looking for a website political journalist. I was keen to get back into politics journalism. I was keen to work with The Guardian, as any sensible journalist should be. And I joined the paper in the days when the newspaper reporters and the website reporters were two separate units. They sat on separate floors in the office. They didn't communicate with each other very much. And I was writing solely for the website, which involved updating stories as the day went on. And it gradually became clear to me that a much more sensible way of doing it would be, instead of writing the same story over and over again, use the form of web journalism, which allows you to do something a bit different. And so increasingly I started writing live blogs for breaking political events. I did a live blog during the 2010 election, which was really successful. Readers liked it a lot, and basically just kept on going from there. I see my job as trying to flag up as much interesting stuff that is out there for people who want to follow politics but haven't got 10 hours a day to scour the web and Twitter and everywhere else. I get up fairly early at home to walk the dog and spend that time listening to the Today programme. I also, on the way in, I'll read The Guardian. There are various email political briefing summaries that I'll read. So by the time I get into the office, which tends to be about 8 o'clock, I've heard what's been going on the radio. I've kind of read the overnight news, and I come in with a view as to what are going to be the things that I'm going to focus on going forward. I use kind of multiple news sources. I get a lot of news from email, as you did in the old days, but increasingly now Twitter is a really important source of what's going on. WhatsApp has become the sort of preferred communication method of choice for people in politics. And lots of us now have a WhatsApp website open on our computers, so that rather than having to faff about on your phone, you can pick up, here we go, because the Tories last night had sent out some embargoed words from the PM. They didn't even bother to send them as an email, but here they are on the WhatsApp group. So those might be useful for me this morning. I work in the Guardian's office in the House of Commons, which is on a corridor where all the national newspapers and big regional newspapers have desks or offices in what's called the press gallery of the House of Commons. It's a wing quite near the chamber, sort of quite near Big Ben. We share an office with Bloomberg, the Yorkshire Post, the Observer. And I come in there and I've got two televisions in front of me, a big Apple Mac, which can have multiple windows open at the same time. I often have the radio on at the same time. If the Commons Chamber is sitting, I'll be watching the Chamber on a live feed. I sit there all day and monitor a lot of the news through live feeds, television, radio, Twitter, email, WhatsApp, colleagues coming in, spin doctors coming around. Occasionally people even ring up with news, but that's much less common these days.
There's a Labour front bencher who had a go at the BBC, which is quite interesting this morning, but it feels like today ought to be a day when you have a general broad picture headline on the blog rather than something very specific and niche. One of the problems about starting covering a new parliament after the election is you're full of MPs that you don't know their names, you don't know who, whether they're Labour or Tory, you don't know which seats they represent, so it'll take us a while to learn all of this. Christian Wakeford, let's see. Yeah, so I'm going to start with a headline with the new MPs arriving in Westminster. So let's just find a few more of them. Aaron Bell, never heard of him, but he's the new MP for Newcastle under Lyme.
The essence of a live blog is you write about the public stuff that's happening at that moment, and wherever it is, I try and write about it. I'm not one of those lobby journalists who goes and has long conversations with people off the record and then kind of writes it up, which is a really important and useful and valuable form of journalism. But you can't do that at the same time if you're trying to write a blog which has to be updated every 5, 10, 15 minutes or so. So I'm mostly sat behind a screen trying to use digital media to keep abreast of what seem to be the most interesting things happening at that moment.
Right, that's ready to go. And then once the blog's ready, I've done my opening post, I give it a quick once over to check that I haven't made any mistakes, and then just press the button. And then we're up. Right, now the politics blog is up. Next important thing of the day is to get some coffee in, and then we'll start beefing it up.
I started doing one-off live blogs in about 2008, 2009, and the live blog became a permanent feature in 2010. And at that stage, Twitter was up and running, but not many people were using it. And during the 2010 campaign, lots of people were telling me they enjoyed my live blog because they felt it was one go-to place for news. And increasingly now, those people are using Twitter as their go-to place. So I have had to change the way I do the blog, partly in response to Twitter. I'm like, Twitter is unedited, unmediated, it's a complete mess. A lot of it's rubbish, some of it's really good. And one part of what I do is essentially editing Twitter, sort of choosing the good stuff, ignoring the bad stuff, and flagging it up for people who don't have 10 hours a day to read Twitter or read the internet. I see myself as performing an editing function to say, well, look, this is the stuff that's really valuable. You should read this and you don't need to trawl the rest of it because I've done it for you. That system broke down last week because various political editors were retweeting stuff that they thought came from a reliable source and it turned out to be wrong. I wish it hadn't happened like that, but by and large I'm pretty cautious and I'm using people that I know. And it's unusual in politics for people to say something they absolutely know to be untrue, although I think it's become less unusual than it was. And a lot of what I do now is increasingly trying to basically fact check the claims that have been made by politicians, saying, well, Boris Johnson's saying this, but that's not strictly true, or sort of, that's misleading, or a fairer way of describing it would be that. What's important is to try and always present the most true an accurate version of events that you can.
So the reader here is saying thank you for the election coverage, so I'm just writing a quick note saying thank you, and that's much appreciated. I've been doing the blog now for about 10 years, so one thing about doing it day in, day out is people get to know you and you get to know the people who post below the line regularly. So we don't send each other Christmas cards, but you have a relationship with people, and it's a relationship that I certainly value, and I just feel it makes me a better journalist, I think, being able to engage that way and have a clear sense of what people are interested in and worried about and happy with or unhappy with. Readers understand that if you are writing stuff up and trying to report and explain in real time, then basic errors creep in from, sometimes, often it's just typing mistakes or spelling mistakes. Whenever mistakes get made, we will correct them as quickly as possible. And one of the advantages of live blog is you can correct stuff within seconds. And if readers flag things up to me, editors flag things up to me, politicians flag things up to me, where we make mistakes, we correct them very, very quickly. Hiya. How was your election? Okay, well, actually, Premier in Breakfast is good. So that would be a bonus in my book. Yeah, I'd rather have them. I mean, I really enjoy it, and I feel I've got one of the best jobs in The Guardian and in political journalism, because I have a huge amount of freedom to write about things that I find interesting in a way that I felt that I never had when I was doing newspaper journalism. With a live blog, I pretty much write about everything that I want to. There's lots of stuff that doesn't make a story, but it's interesting and someone enjoys and follows politics would like to know it, or and I can share it and pass it on. So I feel that I have got much more opportunity to have my say doing this than doing conventional journalism. So I can't think of a job that I'd rather do at the moment.
Guardian political correspondent and live blog supremo Andrew Sparrow there. Matthew, let's talk about the new year and what happens after January the 31st or at or around January 31st. It's an incredibly tight timetable, isn't there, for getting that free trade agreement you talked about?
It's incredibly tight. And one of the things we have to remember is the EU has done trade agreements before, which means it has very established processes. I think it was on October 22nd, the EU signed off the pay and rations for Task Force 50. This is back when Parliament was still arguing about whether to have an election. They are set up, they will draw up a mandate quite quickly. Whereas in the UK side, actually, you know, what is the machinery of government? What is the relationship between
who's
Parliament,
doing the negotiations?
Parliament, and how do we ratify it? That's all up in the air.
Absolutely.
Still.
And we are up again. I used to work in DG Trade in the European Commission in a previous life. And we are up against extremely accomplished negotiators. And it's no good coming out with the facile nonsense that it will be easy because we're already in the club. Because all of the quotas have to be redistributed. That would be an enormous argument within the EU, although it will do it, I believe, quite efficiently. They've probably already done it. You know, the government now cannot squirm. It can't blame Parliament. It will be nobody else's fault. It has the levers of Parliament and the machinery of government at its entire disposal. And it will now have to dispose. And I have no confidence. I mean, one of the things that Labour did in the last parliamentary session was see off, I think, three Brexit secretaries and two prime ministers. I'm devastated we didn't manage to see off the third. But it will now be up to the Conservatives to demonstrate that they can negotiate a deal which is good for all of Britain, including the people of Redcar.
But there will be, I mean, this is the, you know, the Sir Ivan Rogers view, our former top ambassador in Brussels.
My former boss.
And Raoul Ruparel, who was, you know, a very sort of respected aide to Theresa May, they both make the argument that the government could legitimately come to a view that this deal will not be worth having, because a free trade agreement that is so thin in that it only addresses tariffs and possibly not all tariffs, it doesn't do anything for regulatory barriers, so, you know, chemicals, they're in trouble. An FTA so thin combined with level playing field commitments so thick, that is adhering to EU practice on state aid, you know, environment, labour, the government may come to a view that this is just not worth the price, because they're going to need that flexibility to adjust and respond.
Do you think that's underlying some of this? We will not extend. They've said this week they're going to legislate to not extend between beyond the end of 2020. Is that, do they know they're not going to get anything worth bothering with within that short time period?
I'm kind of fascinated by the rationale not to extend. I mean, it's very easy to say, well, this is about pleasing the ERG. It's about pleasing a public who wants a faster deal and just want it done. But the experience of Mrs. May is that more time is not necessarily a useful commodity for a prime minister on Europe, actually. You know, every month that passes just means another 10 people going to the ERG weekly meeting. If you combine that with the fact that the EU's position is going to be pretty immovable, that actually does another 2 years buy you very much?
If and we should say, shouldn't we, that it's in the withdrawal agreement that we have to make a decision by when, remind me?
End of June.
Right, about whether July, we extend the transition period by a couple of years.
Like, don't get me wrong, this isn't an endorsement of trying to do a trade agreement in 7 months. You know, I don't think it's a good idea, but you can see where the political logic of saying every month at home is costing me and it's not gaining me anything in the negotiations. You know, I'm not getting 7th freedoms in aviation. Like, you know, this deal is suddenly not expanding over time. Mm. That could drive you to a position where you just say, take what you can get and
potentially walk away. And Robert, there will also be an imperative to try and get on with some of these other things that were in that manifesto, right? I mean, it's very time-consuming, Brexit negotiations, as has been shown.
Although I should point out that the Tory manifesto has explicit commitments to guarantee those the rights of European citizens, explicit commitments, animal welfare, they actually want to be tougher.
Domestically rather than signing up to...
But this is the fascinating thing, though, because Theresa May did a very smart thing where she got ahead of the EU and said, you know, we're going to be the best in the world on animal rights. Of course we are. And then when it appeared in the deal, it was no big deal, right? Because why should that be a problem to us? So it will be interesting to see whether Johnson is actually trying to get ahead of the EU on the level playing field stuff.
For professional reasons, as the director of a think tank which focuses on domestic policy, I really hope that Brexit essentially over the next year becomes a sort of almost a sort of technical background issue, and everyone it's sort of dealt with by people like Matthew who really can understand, you know,
who know what they're doing, for whom
diving into the exact details of a draft treaty and like paragraph 75 subsection B2 is like a warm bath. Bluntly, during those agonizing few years, the EU really didn't have to offer us much because it knew that whatever it offered, it had people in the UK who genuinely believed that Remain was the best option and would do anything they could to sabotage and weaken a Brexit deal. So it had quite a lot of people here working to help dilute any attempt by the government to pull away. That's not going to be the case now. But I think that, you know, what I also hope is that there is enough goodwill on both sides. I think the Johnson-Varadkar relationship, the fact that, you know, Germany has seen its own economy suffer due to the uncertainties. You know, I think people are, I think there's, you know, Europe wants to get this done as much as we
do. But there is at least political clarity, right? I mean, I think there was sometimes a sense of is this government sustainable? Might there be some alternative that might take a different view?
We spent 2 years negotiating amongst ourselves before we actually started negotiating with Europe.
I think with hindsight, we can all say that the start of the Brexit process was very, very badly handled. There should have been much more reflection and real analysis before the famous trigger of Article 50.
Which Jeremy Corbyn wanted to do on June 24th.
Well, everybody wanted to do, and I think the instinct from all major parties to honour the result in the first instance was the right one, but I think that it was incredibly badly handled.
Laura, Labour has obviously been busy in mutual recrimination since the early hours of last Friday morning. Everybody has their own explanation as to why the election was lost. It's a very big decision coming up, isn't there, about who should succeed Jeremy Corbyn. I wonder, I don't know if you want to name your favourite candidate, but I wonder what you think people should be thinking about when they're making that decision.
I definitely don't want to name my favourite candidate, not least because I'm not entirely certain who the candidates
are.
Indeed. What for me is important is that we retain the radicalism of the agenda. We must have a leader who is unequivocally committed to taking on racism, bigotry and all forms of discrimination wherever we may find them. So I really want a leader of vision and values. They'll have to have broad shoulders because they've got a big job to do.
Matthew, where does it make sense for that new Labour leader to put themselves on Brexit? Do you think that will be one of the huge issues that the party will have to face in deciding who should succeed Jeremy Corbyn?
They will, and there's two questions. One is, what does a pro-European party do outside the EU other than rejoin? And I think there's a big space for that because there are lots of things you can do as a European nation with the EU from outside. And people like Douglas Carswell and Dan Hannan used to talk about them a lot and might be talking about them more. The other question, which goes back to the point that Rob raised, is do you choose to now de-dramatise Brexit or do we continue the civil war? And that question will raise itself for Labour if the ERG and others split from the Conservative Party. And the Labour Party will have to have a choice of whether they support the ERG against the Prime Minister, perhaps putting yourself on course for a very, very hard exit, but with the upside of damaging Boris Johnson, or whether they choose to support the government as a bulwark against the ERG. And that will be a very, very difficult dilemma. I suspect for many Labour MPs, you know, they just will not feel able to vote for any sort of Brexit deal and want to sit it out entirely.
And Robert, I wonder who would be the potential, when you look at the field, the potential candidate that the Conservatives might most worry about, do you think?
Well, I am the very last person you should ask this question to, because in 2015, I was a journalist, and I wrote a sort of snap analysis piece. And I said, well, Ed Miliband has failed. Quite clearly, Labour need to tack back to the centre, and it's Chuck Aramuna's time to shine.
So, the kiss of death.
I think the mistake I made then was I was thinking cephalogically rather than psychologically. And I think that this is one of the questions for Labour. Do they try and calculate who is the best person to win back, not just voters in the North, but this whole swathe of voters who abandon them? Or do they kind of go for someone who makes them feel better? And the only thing I'd say is that I am sort of 99% sure it'll be a woman, because just whenever I've talked to someone on the Labour side, it feels like the fact that even the Lib Dems have now got to have, for the Party of Equality to have been beaten by the other parties to having female leaders is a really bad look. And that's like the motif which has come through again and again. But then again, you know, I genuinely don't know. I think there are a lot of people that the Conservatives would fear, but I don't think they're the ones who are going to win it.
Well, there's no doubt there will be lots of news for us to sink our teeth into when we come back in the new year, but I'm signing off for a couple of weeks for some much needed rest. I hope all of you listening have a wonderful Christmas, and make sure to come back to us on the 8th of January. If you want even more Brexit chat over the festive period, make sure to have a listen to the latest episode of our sister pod, Brexit Means, with John Henley, Anna Menon, Joe Owen and Jennifer Rankin. But for now, my thanks to all our guests, Liz McInnes, Laura Parker, Robert Colville, Matthew Holhouse, Rajiv Sial and Andrew Sparrow. The producer was Danielle Stevens. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.